This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Welcome to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Hi, I'm Jamie Bussin. I'm a former commercial litigator who used to weigh 242 pounds. When I was 38 years old, I lost over 50 pounds through a regimen of exercise and better nutrition. It took me a year to reach my goal, but I thought if a type A personality like me could do it, really anybody can. I'm still asking questions and learning about what it means to live a healthy lifestyle. Please join me on this continuing journey. Today, we'll discuss the treatment of ovarian cancer with CEO of Ovarian Cancer Canada, Tanya Vriones. We'll discover the best way to get protein into every meal with registered dietitian Shauna Lindzen. We'll find out how to raise your kinks and desires with your partner with sex and intimacy coach Serena Haynes. And lastly, we'll learn why self-ageism is holding you back with author Chantal Bisson. Before we get to that, here's your Tonic Quick Shot. A study founded by the National Institutes of Health has found major changes in the immune system of the hippocampus, a part of the brain important for learning and memory. Researchers say these changes may begin in midlife and could help explain the long-term brain inflammation linked to some neurodegenerative diseases. The researchers studied brain tissue from 40 healthy adults between the ages of 20 and 95. They found that microglia, the brain's main immune cells, gradually decline between the ages of 50 and 75. At the same time, these cells appeared to be replaced by cells with stronger inflammatory signals and traits similar to immune cells found in the blood. The findings challenged the long-held belief that microglia stay in the brain and continue to renew themselves throughout life. Researchers also found signs of age-related decline in cells that help protect the blood-brain barrier. Future studies will examine why these immune changes happen and whether they contribute to Alzheimer's disease and other neurological conditions linked to aging. I'll be joined by Tanya Vriones in a minute, but first, a little bit of business. Question: what's the best way to make sure you're getting the most up-to-date and accurate health and wellness information? Answer: the Tonic newsletter, of course. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. Each year, over 3,000 women are diagnosed with ovarian cancer across Canada. Known as a silent killer, this cancer poses many unique challenges. In addition to vague symptoms and frequent misdiagnosis, most present with late-stage disease and will typically undergo surgery followed by platinum-based chemotherapy. Health Canada has approved a new treatment called Elahere for platinum-resistant ovarian cancer, but women can't access it. Today, we're speaking with Tanya Vriones, CEO of Ovarian Cancer Canada, to explain the lay of the land. Welcome to The Tonic, Tanya. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. Thanks so much for having me.
So for those who don't know, why is ovarian cancer so very difficult to diagnose?
So there's several reasons why ovarian cancer is difficult to diagnose. First and foremost, it's not just one cancer. Ovarian cancer is actually many different cancers, and there's several subtypes that all respond differently. Most importantly, though, I would say that there is currently no effective screening test for ovarian cancer, and that's a very common misconception in that many people believe that the Pap test, the things that we go for regularly, screens for ovarian cancer, and it does not. So that's a really important thing to understand. There is currently no effective screening test for ovarian cancer. And as you just mentioned, the symptoms for ovarian cancer are quite vague. They're things that women experience fairly regularly in our lives due to all kinds of reasons, whether it's bloating, it's changes in urinary and bowel habits, it's cramping, things like that that we can often dismiss or can be dismissed as attributable to other things. So all of these things combined make it incredibly difficult to detect and diagnose ovarian cancer until it is late stage, as you mentioned.
Who's most at risk for developing ovarian cancer?
So there's several risk factors to ovarian cancer. First and foremost, overall, age. Age is the most common risk factor, as it is typically diagnosed over the age of 55 postmenopause. That said, it absolutely can affect any woman, but that is the most typical age of diagnosis. But there's also other risk factors. About 20% of the population have an inherited genetic mutation that they may not know about. That's most commonly the BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation or Lynch syndrome. And that is attributable also to those with a strong family history of ovarian cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer, pancreatic cancer. There's linkages with some of those genetic mutations in all of those cancers. We also know that there is a tie to some reproductive factors. So women who have never been pregnant, or they started their menstrual cycle younger in life before the age of 12, or started menopause later in life, they're at higher risk. So basically, the more periods a woman has, the higher the risk. And then, of course, there's also a risk factor around endometriosis. So those are some of the risk factors associated with ovarian cancer.
It's interesting that that age is the highest correlator, particularly after perimenopause and menopause, suggesting that perhaps there's ties to hormone changes.
Perhaps, yeah. Those are all things that we're learning more about with research.
Off the top, I reference platinum-resistant ovarian cancer. Can you explain to the listeners what that is?
So for solid tumors, which is what ovarian cancer typically is, most first-line chemotherapies, that first treatment that people will receive, are platinum-based. And that type of chemotherapy is actually early on known to be the most effective and has fewer side effects. It's known to really activate the immune system and to really go after those cancer cells, which is what you want when you're receiving treatment for cancer. However, our bodies are incredible at adapting and not always for the better. So unfortunately, up to 85% of women receiving this type of chemotherapy can eventually develop a resistance to platinum. And what that means is that chemotherapy no longer becomes effective and the cancer recurs. At this point, there are very few, if any, options available at that stage. And unfortunately, the survival rate once platinum resistance has been identified and cancer has recurred, it's known to be less than a year. It's not a good place to be.
Oh, gosh. Your organization has a new campaign, which is Share Your Voice. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. And this goes back to just our conversation about platinum-resistant ovarian cancer. So I'm actually going to go back about 4 years in 2022. Our community started hearing about a new and promising, exciting treatment for some women with platinum ovarian cancer that became available in the United States and was really generating hope. And we were actually seeing some of our women in our community cross the border to receive this treatment. There was such a buzz around it. So at that time, we at Ovarian Cancer Canada were advocating strongly to both the manufacturer and to Health Canada to see what it would take to get this treatment here in Canada and to Canadians. So it took some time, but in early 2025, we were just thrilled to see that process finally start here in Canada. And there was such enthusiasm in our community, as it had been more than a decade, more than 10 years, since a new treatment for platinum-resistant ovarian cancer had been introduced. And we know that for this particular group of platinum-resistant patients, there is no other option available. Canada has a very lengthy and complicated process to bring new drugs for drug approvals to bring those drugs to Canadians. So we knew it had a ways to go, but the early signs were just so positive. It received what's called priority review and approval by Health Canada, and a positive recommendation for reimbursement by Canada's drug agency. So that is the first two really important steps in the Canadian process. And perhaps I would say the most important, as that's the signal that our regulators all agree that this is a safe and effective treatment, and that it deserves to be covered through our public health system for those that are eligible. So from there, the next step in the process is the negotiations between the Pan-Canadian Pharmaceutical Alliance, who we'll call the PCPA. So they represent and negotiate on behalf of the collective provinces, and the manufacturer. And that's where price and some other conditions are all negotiated. So this was all moving along well, according to process, and seemed to be moving through. However, earlier this spring, we were quite surprised, a bit blindsided by a notification from the PCPA that the decision had been implemented to end the negotiations without an agreement, which effectively is blocking the path for future public access to this treatment in Canada. An absolutely devastating result. And for our community, that's just an unacceptable conclusion. Frankly, women will die knowing that there was an option available but blocked here in Canada. So how can we possibly be okay with that? So on behalf of our community, Ovarian Cancer Canada, we're demanding that negotiations resume. We've got to get people back to the table. Lives are at stake. So to help with that, we're providing our community and really anyone who believes that Canadians should have access to the most innovative treatments the opportunity to have their voice heard on this issue. So this our Share Your Voice campaign, it provides an easy-to-use tool that will allow for letters through email to government representatives in your area, simply by adding your connection so you can share that you're a patient, a caregiver, or someone just supports this happening, and your postal code. Our system will automatically generate a letter that you can edit as you wish, and it'll automatically populate with your local MLA or MPP, depending on where you live, as well as your premier, health minister, and other relevant ministers, to be able to really share your concern about this breakdown in negotiations and add your voice to demanding that they get back to the table. And already, in just the first few weeks of the campaign, more than 4,000 Canadians have sent almost 18,000 emails through our system. So those numbers are growing every single day. So we're just really inspired by the action that we're seeing Canadians take on this issue.
Do you know why the negotiations broke off?
No, unfortunately, all the details around negotiations are confidential, and we recognize that they're complex. But for the people waiting for this drug, it's really quite simple. They need access, and they need it now.
Isn't the mandate, correct me if I'm wrong, if they're just negotiating price, isn't it pretty much the issue, the only issue? Like, what other issues would there be?
Yeah, that's a great question. Apparently, there is a lot behind kind of the pharmacoeconomics around not only price but value for the benefits that the drug brings. There's a number of things that are all discussed as part of these negotiations. Again, not details that we're privy to, but of course, price certainly plays a role in this.
So, and maybe you know the answer to this, and maybe you don't, but when they did the testing on the drug to get it to that point, is it that the efficacies aren't for everybody who has the disease? In other words, does it only help like 30 or 40%? Is that perhaps what's driving the lack of negotiations?
I don't believe that would be of your driving the lack of negotiations. I mean, we do know that it is a small population of ovarian cancer patients that would be eligible for this. This is about precision medicine or personalized medicine, and this is about knowing who will react or who has the potential to see real benefit from the drug. I think the bigger issue at play here is the precedent as well that it sets for future therapies of this nature. The future of medicine is personalized. How great it is that research has gotten us to the point where we're able to know before we throw a treatment at somebody what the likelihood of success is there. And those treatments do come at a cost, and our system is not set up to appropriately manage those costs. So while the high cost per individual may be a barrier, the reality is that the number of patients accessing that treatment and what that frees up in resources across the rest of the health system need to be taken into account as well.
Do you think our governments and health policymakers are prioritizing women's health issues like ovarian cancer?
You know, I think in principle, governments and policymakers all agree that women's health should be a priority. In fact, we're seeing a Senate bill, Bill S-243, which is another initiative that Ovarian Cancer Canada is involved in. That's going to establish a legal framework for women's health. It's working its way through the government process as we speak. So that's getting a lot of attention, and government and policymakers all agree that that's a great thing. I would also add that specific to ovarian cancer, as people learn about ovarian cancer and the limited progress in moving the needle on improving survival, you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone in government who wouldn't agree that this is something we should do something about this. But it's how that priority comes to life in our fragmented Canadian health system. I think that's the real challenge here. And this issue of access and this particular drug is a real-time example. So I would actually commend the federal government in several provinces, I'll name Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and Nova Scotia, for investing in ovarian cancer research through direct support to our research program. And they've signaled, in doing that, they've signaled that ovarian cancer is a priority, and we're incredibly grateful for that. But here's the thing, one of the main objectives to research is developing new and better treatments. So blocking the very treatments that research can lead to just highlights this massive disconnect. So to think that ultimately Canadian research might end up benefiting people in other countries, but not here, I mean, just make that make sense. We need to actually bring these things to life and that priority.
So, in your opinion, how should we prioritize ovarian cancer?
I think it's about connecting those dots and following the thread all the way through. You know, from prioritizing research to developing those early detection tools to, you know, clearing the pathway to new and innovative treatments getting to women and getting all of these advances right to Canadians, right? We have to stop this siloed approach and ensure that when it's being handed off from one area to the next, that priority continues to follow through.
So Ovarian Cancer Canada is leading research. What are some of the projects that you're most excited about?
It's really hard to pick, as there's just so many that hold progress. I think or promise, since we're just really starting to see some real progress. So since 2021, just in the last 5 years, Ovarian Cancer Canada has invested more than $20 million in Canadian research, and it just feels like we're making such significant progress just now, and that next big breakthrough is right around the corner. But if I had to pick, I would say I'm really excited about some of the early detection projects that we're currently funding. And that's a concept that was unheard of just a few years ago. We wouldn't have known enough about the disease to be able to really invest in early detection. So we're currently funding one project on an enhanced blood test that's happening in Kingston, Ontario, and another focused on fallopian tube imaging that's happening in Vancouver, British Columbia. So lots of excitement around the potential of those projects. But I'd also be remiss if I didn't mention the incredible work happening in immunotherapy in Nova Scotia. Immunotherapy is an area that we're seeing such advances in other cancers. It's really proving to be the big breakthrough. And yet that progress in ovarian cancer in immunotherapy has been trickier. But we're finally now just starting to see that progress and funding some significant work there. So those are just a few. I could probably spend hours talking about all of the great work happening right here in Canada that's funded through our research program, and that's just really driving hope and excitement.
Unfortunately, we only have time for one last question, and that is, in addition to the greater medication access and the research, what is the greatest need for our ovarian cancer community, in your view?
I would continue to say it's that continued research. The more we learn, the more we know, the more progress we can make. We are behind in other cancers, but we're finally making that ground, and that breakthrough is coming, but we have to continue to invest to take things to the next stage.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today and explaining that.
I appreciate the opportunity and would love a chance to be back.
That was Tanya Vriones. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss how to get more protein into your diet on The Tonic.
I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com. Feeling tired, low on energy, or simply not getting enough vitamin B12? Discover the difference with Purely Organic Active B12. Made with premium active methylcobalamin, the natural form your body absorbs and uses instantly. Unlike common synthetic B12 supplements, Purely Organic Active B12 contains no colors, flavors, sweeteners, or preservatives. Just clean, organic, vegan support for energy, endurance, and nervous system health. Purely Organic Active B12. Pure energy, naturally made in Canada.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Shauna Lindzen is a dietitian and nutritionist. She is a program developer and nutrition leader at Wellspring Cancer Support Network and enjoys seeing clients virtually and doing corporate wellness lectures. She runs practical cooking demonstrations that combine scientific knowledge with culinary education. Her demonstrations are unique, informative, delicious, and a lot of fun. And you can find a list of her nutrition classes and recipes at shaunalindzen.com. Welcome back to the show, Shauna. It's been a while.
It's been a while, Jamie. Nice to be here.
So, you know, the hot topic of the day, and everybody's doing this, is we got to get more protein into our diet. And,
yes.
And I thought it would be fun to bring you back on the show to discuss all the ways in which we can do that, because frankly, I'm running out of ideas. Are you with me?
Yes, I'm here and I've got lots of ideas for you.
Okay, so first of all, we should probably ground this. How much protein do most people actually need throughout the day? And does it make a difference if we're spreading it across meals?
Good question. So our protein needs are dependent upon how old we are, our health status, how much physical activity we do. So those are kind of the three factors that we calculate protein needs from. So for instance, if we have, let's calculate protein for a 150-pound person, right? So just average, I'm going to say that that person needs about 68, 70 grams of protein. And if you want to get really technical, we do it per about 1 gram per kilogram of body weight per day.
Mm-hmm. So what would that look like? So what did you say, 60 to 80 grams? Or did I mishear you?
So about 70, let's say about 70 grams if you're 150 pound person.
Okay, so what would that look like? What does 70 grams of protein look like?
So, you know how people say you need about 20 to 30 grams of protein at each meal.
Okay.
So what does that look like? So we want to make it as simple as we can for people to kind of figure it out. So if we're looking at consuming, let's say, about 20 to 30 grams of protein per meal, I'm going to give you some really practical examples.
Sure.
So let's start off with breakfast. For breakfast, most people go, some people don't eat breakfast, which I think isn't the best move.
Yep.
I think it's really important to eat a high protein breakfast in the day, because that will start you off with fuel and it will give you that satiety, that feeling of fullness. So if we want to hit 20 to 30 grams of protein at breakfast, some people will do it on kind of like a vegetable-based breakfast, or some people will do it on an animal-based breakfast. I'm talking about getting their protein in. So an example of an animal-based breakfast would be having maybe an egg or two, some Greek yogurt, cottage cheese, high-protein milk, and mixing that with different fruit, different carbohydrates like oatmeal, bread, even rice like congee, that type of thing. Other people like to do it through the vegetarian option. So an example of that would be a tofu scramble, or maybe a black bean breakfast wrap. You could put in like egg. It depends if you're vegetarian or vegan. So there are lots of animal-based proteins, and then there's vegetable-based protein.
What about lunchtime?
So I think the best way to do it, there's two ways. You can either do a bowl, like a salad bowl or a noodle bowl. And most of, if you're buying lunch out in all the different restaurants that you would buy lunch at, they typically will give you options of having like a lunch salad or a lunch bowl. It is imperative to choose protein with the salad or the noodle bowl or a lunch plate in general. So examples of that would be just literally a salad with a piece of salmon on top or chicken breast on top. If you decide to go the vegetarian route, you can have lentils, chickpeas, edamame, tofu. Those those are all going to give you 20 to 30 grams of protein at lunch.
Are all of the animal-based proteins the same? Like, it's not the same if you're having, like, bacon as it would be to have chicken breast,
no.
Right? Like,
yeah, like, I'm going to tell you, the most, you know, the least nutrition protein choice would be an ultra-processed meat.
Right.
Because lots of things come with it, like salt and nitrates, things that aren't so healthy for us. The highest amount of protein you can get is from chicken. Chicken breast in general gives us the highest amount of protein, the most bang for your buck.
All right. Let's shift gears and talk about dinner. I presume there's more options at dinner, or maybe I'm wrong.
No, it's, you know what, like breakfast, some people do breakfast for dinner type of thing. The easiest way to get your protein at dinner is if you are a meat, fish, or poultry eater. Mm-hmm. You can have, let's say, a 6 to 8 ounce piece of cooked chicken, meat, or fish. So for chicken, you're going to get the most amount of protein. So let's say like a 6 to 8 ounce piece of chicken breast is going to give you about 40 to 50 grams of protein. And meat is going to give you somewhere between, you know, late 30s, early 40s, if we're talking about 6 ounces of meat, which is equivalent to the size of like 2 decks of cards.
Okay, so I've been focusing on getting, for me, it was always lunch was the hard one for me to get my protein in, because I think we've discussed it before. I have egg white oatmeal for breakfast. That's easy peasy. And, you know, I usually have, you know, some sort of animal-based protein for dinner, or maybe beans and rice and something like that for dinner. But lunch was like leftovers, and sometimes I'd get lazy and it wouldn't be necessarily protein forward. But now that I'm doing it, what I'm finding is I'm getting bored with eating the same proteins over and over again. Are there protein sources that perhaps I'm not thinking about that I should turn my mind to that might be suitable?
Yeah, maybe. So good examples would be, let's say, edamame or the immature soybean, which come as a frozen protein source. So if you actually eat a cup of edamame, let's say you just throw it on into your leftover rice, you throw it into your salad, that's going to give you 17 grams of protein. Another really big one are chickpeas. One cup of chickpeas have almost 40 grams of protein, like 30 something grams of protein. You can also add things to your leftovers like Parmesan cheese, hemp seeds, pumpkin seeds. A really easy one, Jamie, which I think, I'm not sure if you're a fish eater. Are you a fish eater?
I am.
Okay. Tinned fish are, it's one of those foods that people forget about. So tinned mackerel, tinned sardines, tinned salmon, tinned tuna, you can literally open up that can of tinned fish and put it onto your leftovers. And that's just shooting up your protein. What about a tuna melt, a salmon melt, that putting cheese on top of the fish and just melting it in? I think that's delicious. Yeah. B, you're getting lots of protein from the cheese and the fish.
Are there any misconceptions that you hear in your practice, people thinking about, you know, ways of getting as it pertains to protein?
Yeah, like lots of people think that pasta doesn't have protein. So durum wheat semolina, like typical pasta, a cooked portion of pasta has about 7 to 12 grams of protein. If you buy pasta that is bean-based, like there's lots of chickpea pastas on the market, that has double the protein. So think about it, Jamie. If you decide you have, you know, you don't have leftovers for lunch, if you cook up some chickpea pasta, you could even throw in some marinara sauce with some cottage cheese pureed or some tofu pureed into it to make a rosé sauce. That's right there, you're having 30 grams of protein, if not more.
Do you think that people should be focusing on getting protein in their snacks as well? Is that necessary?
I think a little bit. I don't think you need, like, if you are achieving it at your meals, your snacks should just be focused on getting something you enjoy. Like, I usually say nuts and fruit are good snacks. I like people to get fiber in their snacks. And sometimes protein and fiber mixed. For instance, hummus has protein and fiber. Other things like I was mentioning, edamame. So any of the plant-based proteins do come with fiber. A really good snack would be like a bean salad. So for instance, if you have like a black bean salad with, I just actually made a Texas caviar salad for one of my cooking demos, which had black-eyed peas in it with peppers and tomatoes and all of that in it. It's almost like a Southwestern salsa. That's a fantastic snack with crackers because you're getting fiber, you're getting protein. You can't forget about the fiber. People who try to eat more protein often forget that they also have to eat other nutrients that are important.
Of course.
So this also brings us back to when we always talk about a whole food diet. So if you eat whole foods, for instance, apples, fish, you know, foods that look like what they are before they're ultra processed, you are going to get protein, fiber, healthy fats from the whole foods. So that's what your snacks should contain, are whole foods, like an apple and a chunk of cheese, for instance, or as I said, like crackers and a bean salad, hummus and dip, a banana with nut butter with hemp seeds sprinkled on it. There are so many quick and easy snacks that contain protein, fiber, and healthy fats.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Jamie.
That was Shauna Lindzen. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss how to raise your kinks and desires with your partner on The Tonic. Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal. Organic or wild-crafted, these oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety including argan, rosehip, or skin lover's blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores. Feeling tired, low on energy, or simply not getting enough vitamin B12? Discover the difference with Purely Organic Active B12. Made with premium active methylcobalamin, the natural form your body absorbs and uses instantly. Unlike common synthetic B12 supplements, Purely Organic Active B12 contains no colors, flavors, sweeteners, or preservatives. Just clean, organic, vegan support for energy, endurance, and nervous system health. Purely Organic Active B12. Pure energy, naturally made in Canada.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Serena Haynes is a certified sexologist, sex and intimacy coach, somatic sex educator, and has studied clinical sexology. She has a background in psychology and has studied relational counseling. She also has studied relationship counseling through the Gottman Institute. Serena is here to help guide you forward on your journey to sexual expansion, whether it's physical, such as erectile challenges, difficulty with orgasms, or your intimacy with yourself or your partners. For more information about Serena, you can visit serenahaynes.com. Welcome back to the show, Serena. How are you doing?
Thank you so much. I'm doing really well. I hope you're doing well.
I am doing well.
Good.
So we're going to talk about something we've never, ever covered on the show, and I think you're the perfect person for it. And that is how to raise desires and perhaps kinks with your partner. You up for the task?
Oh, I'm up for the task. I was excited when I figured we were going to talk about this today. It's something that we don't talk about enough. And when we do, we whisper about it and we don't use the right words. And everybody is very confused about the whole thing.
Yeah. Why can it feel so intimidating to tell somebody who, you know, presumably you've been with for a while and know very well about a desire or a kink? Why is that?
Yeah, there's a lot of reasons. I mean, the biggest one is obviously it's really vulnerable. It's a really vulnerable thing to share with somebody. This is the depths of your imagination. It's the depths of your desires that, you know, we've kind of been told and socialized over the years that anything that isn't vanilla, anything that isn't childbearing, anything that isn't, you know, like just what you think sex is supposed to be is shameful. It's dark. It's, you know, the red rooms and all of the chains and all of the things. But it doesn't have to be that. It can really just be something, you know, something that you feel that you are or that you love from the inside, from your imagination, and sharing that with another person puts you in a pretty vulnerable state for judgment or, you know, questioning. So I think being able to have those conversations with your partner are really important. And it does lead to some pretty fun conversations, if I do say so myself.
Yeah. I think, you know, even with somebody who you've been with for a while. So when we're talking about a partner, we're not talking about somebody new. We're talking about, you know, you're in a long-term relationship, theoretically.
Okay.
You kind of know what they're about. And you may in your head be working through, you know, what is their reaction going to be based on reactions they've had to other conversations, not necessarily right. about that topic. But I think we all kind of know how our partner operates and what their mindset is. And perhaps it speaks to how you feel about your relationship, a reluctance to raise things. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. You know, the thing that I find a lot with couples, especially long-term couples, is it's bittersweet what you just said, because it is true. You do know your partner. You know what their reactions are going to be. You have this history, these patterns, right? And that's what we rely on in the world. We rely on our patterns to kind of navigate us through the world. But the beautiful thing about human relations is that we're supposed to change and grow, and we're supposed to be curious about the world around us and be curious about our inner world. And having these conversations with your partner, it's an opportunity for you both to grow in it with the right conversation. You know, you're not kind of going to come out to your partner and be like, oh my God, we have to do this right now today. This is amazing.
Right.
Or I've been thinking about this for so long and I feel like I've kept to myself because you're not a good listener. Right. We don't say those things.
Or in a million years, you'll never do this. Yeah. Okay.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Right. But if we use different language around things, just as I said, you know, we've grown together for so long and I'm really, the word that I really like to use, I think we're leading into a little bit more of the conversation that you and I were going to have, but the words that I really like to use are curious. I love the word curious, curiosity, you know, and thinking about things. So you go to your partner and you say, I've been really curious about something. I've been thinking about this for a really long time. And I'm wondering, you know, what if, or even for a day, you know, or I'm wondering how you feel about it. Have you ever been curious about something that you don't feel safe telling me because we've never really had these conversations before, but maybe it's time for us to spread our kinky wings, if you will.
What do you think when somebody hears that? Because it's not just what you want and what you're going to say. It's how they're going to process that information, mm-hmm. right? Like it isn't just expressing yourself. It's making it clear that you're just sharing that information. It isn't necessarily something you want to act on or that they right. should feel compelled to act on, right?
That's such an important point, Jamie. Like. The people who hear, let's say we have two people in a relationship, one that's maybe a little bit more curious and wants to talk about it. And the other one is going to take that as, oh my God, this means I have to do this today.
Right.
What you want to say to your partner is that just what you said very clearly, you know, my imagination thinks about these things. I have these desires within, I have these thoughts that I think about and, you know, these things that I'm curious about. In absolutely no way does that mean that we have to, you know, facilitate them or bring them into reality. The thing is, when it comes to our fantasies and desires, they're fantasies and desires because they're usually things we actually don't want to do in real life. They feed off of our, sometimes off of our biggest insecurities. You know, there's, you know, some people who maybe would want to have a third person. That's the most common fantasy, right? That we talk about the third person. But the thing is, in your fantasy, it's so safe because there's always, you know, there's no performance problems. Yeah. There's no, you know, no intimacy problems. The conversations always go exactly as you want them because you're in control. It's in your imagination. It's fantasy. So bringing that into real life is really a tough transition for a lot of people, regardless of what that fantasy is. So telling your partner that right off the bat, you know, I don't need to do this, but I think it'd be really cool if we could have a conversation about it, because sharing our desires, I think, makes us feel a little, it makes me feel a little bit closer to you. And, you know, I'd be interested in how you feel about it. But in no way does it mean we have to do this together.
Well, let's talk about the dynamics for a second. So your partner comes to you and says, here's something that I've been thinking about. I think automatically that person would presume whether or not you're actually going to follow through, there is a desire on some level to do so. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, do you find that that person in the relationship feels undue pressure? And how do you navigate that?
And they can. And I think it's just really important to understand that might exist, you know, and a really great way of framing that is, you know, this is the fantasy that I'm having. This is the desire. This is what I'm curious about, whatever that is. And then asking your partner if there's any level of that they would be interested in as well. Like, where are you on 1 to 10 on a scale, or 1 to 5 on that fantasy with me? Is it a 0? Is it a 5? And if it's a 0, then you just say, well, that's cool, thanks for listening. Or do you want to hear more about my fantasy? It's really just, if we think about it more like storytelling than leading us into things that we actually have to do, we feel less pressure to perform, and then also less rejection. You know, as the person sharing your desire and your fantasy, if your partner comes back and says, you know, I'm really not interested in that, you can just consider it, you know, thanks for listening to me tell my story. Now you know something a little bit different about me. You know, is there any level of that you would ever be curious about? And if there is, come and let me know, right? Because somebody could think to themselves, I always liken it to being on chapter 12 of a book and then handing it to somebody and expecting them to know exactly what's going on in chapter 12. If we are the people thinking about it, we've likely thought about it for quite a while, regardless of what it is. Mm-hmm. So now we're coming out to our partner and we're going to jump right in. We're going to be like, oh, this is what I've thought about, and this is how it goes, and this is what turns me on and my desire. And yeah, it can be a little bit of a shell shock for your partner thinking, oh my gosh, like, I've not been there thinking about that at all. So then you ask your partner, is there any level of that intrigues you or that makes you curious? And can we talk about your level? So we kind of work with the partner's level of comfort that is less than ours, right? We never want to force them into catching up to chapter 12. Some people are a bit are slower readers than others.
I hear you. I think somebody who, let's just call it putting themselves out there, like expressing those desires, right? So you express your desire to your partner, and then your partner, for whatever reason, quite honestly says, yeah, I hear you, I understand you, but I don't think I can do that, or I'm not really interested. Mm-hmm. I would think the person who's making the disclosure would feel, I don't know, rejected on some level, or perhaps embarrassed that they put themselves out there. It's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy. Well, that's why I didn't raise it with that person mm-hmm. before, because this is what I was afraid of. How do we broach that? Like, how do you get over that?
Well, I mean, going into it, if you're listening and you do have something that you want to talk to your partner about, just understanding that your partner doesn't have to love the same things you love ever. You know,
we really don't.
Yeah, like, we don't have to be there. And that's not rejection. If you go out for dinner and you say, oh my God, I really want steak, and your partner goes, ew, I don't want steak, I'd really like some fish, you don't feel rejected, you just get the steak. Now, that doesn't say that we're going to go out and get our desires without our partners, but those desires and fantasies still are allowed to live in your head. And then if we do feel that rejection from our partners, and it really is prominent, right? Like, maybe there's some criticism or some contempt, or, you know, something that's going to make us feel bad. That's a bit of a bigger conversation that you're going to have with your partner. But going into these things, expecting your partner to kind of jump on board, you may be setting yourself up for failure. So just understand that when you go in, you are just sharing something about yourself. And hopefully your partner says, I hear you, that sounds great, but I don't really want to do it. And then you have to realize that it's not rejection of you as a person. That's just kind of a rejection of the fantasy that you're having. They're not into it. That's okay. But that doesn't mean they don't still love, respect, adore, desire you the exact same way they always did. You guys just have different curiosities, and maybe something that, you know, is open to having a conversation about. But if not, then you get to continue to live that in your head, in your fantasy.
Is this something that's frequently resolved in one conversation, though? I mean, if somebody if somebody expresses a desire and the person says, well, I don't know about that, like, is there a way to revisit it? Is it an open-ended conversation, or is that not a good idea because then you're just revisiting the same potential discord?
Well, as I said in the beginning, you know, we should be growing and learning all throughout our relationships, but making sure that we're doing that really tenderly going forward. So asking your partner at the end of that conversation, hey, you know, I understand that you don't really love this, and that's totally okay. It's something that I like, and, you know, I'm going to think about it. In no way does it mean that you need to perform it, and in no way do I feel super rejected right now. This is great. I'm glad we're having this conversation. I'd love to revisit this another time. Like, do you think that you would ever be open to having this conversation? And hopefully your partner says, you know, I don't know if I would ever be open to doing it, but of course you're always welcome to share your thoughts with me, right? Of course you're always welcome to share your curiosities with me, because it's not bringing it up in order to pressure them into it. It's just bringing it up again, maybe in, you know, 6 months from now, or maybe something's changed or whatever's going on, just to check in, just to have a little feedback session. We should be doing that with our partners over an array of different things. And your sexuality and your fantasies shouldn't be just pushed to the wayside. You know, we have little budget meetings with our partners. You know, if something's going on, or if somebody's changing jobs or careers, or there's something going on, you sit down, you have a little team meeting, and you figure out what's going to happen with your life. Your sexuality shouldn't be just hidden under the bed, so to speak. And that could be something that you say to your partner, you know, I'd like to put this in the budget meeting for this month, you know, and be able to have a little conversation about where we stand on this. And there's no pressure to change your mind. I just really like talking about it with you.
That makes a lot of sense. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me. Anytime.
That was Serena Haynes. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss how self-ageism is holding you back on The Tonic. I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian-owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000-square-foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Chantal Bisson is a best-selling author, a parenting mentor, and lifestyle brand founder known for her empowering voice and raw authenticity. With her brand, Without Losing Your Cool, she's helped thousands of people navigate life, parenthood, trauma, and personal growth through real talk, personal storytelling, and practical tools. A mother of three, Chantal brings lived experience to her books and podcast that makes you feel seen, heard, and inspired. Whether she's writing, speaking, or sharing daily insights, her mission is to help others break cycles, heal wounds, and live fully in their truth with hope for the future. Welcome back to the show, Chantal. How are you?
Thank you, Jamie. Great to be here with you again. I'm great. How are you?
Doing well. So I'm of a certain age where, like, I've gotten into the habit of thinking of myself as that age and almost explaining myself, either to myself or to others, you know, saying stuff like, I think I look pretty good for my age, or,
right. You know,
or justifying maybe why I can't lift as much. But you think that might be a problem, right?
I do. I believe that it is a problem that we just a slippery slope that we get into, either through our social circles and the way we speak with our peers, and we sort of commiserate together on aging. And we may do it jokingly, you know, like, oh, the knees just don't work the way they used to. Or to your point, I can't lift as heavy as I can, but hey, I'm still lifting. I've still kind of sort of got it.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting that we don't even realize how it slips into our daily conversation. And then, of course, it becomes daily habit and pattern of belief in aging that we really can circumvent if we stop joining the jokes about aging.
Yeah. Before sort of being aware of this topic, this notion, I always thought those things that I was saying, you know, in a self-deprecating way, was a way of just sort of coping, and everybody goes through it and everybody understands it. But it is actually negative.
It is absolutely negative. You're 100% correct.
So what are some of the common age-related beliefs that people internalize that can limit what they do or what they pursue?
Well, first, we need to recognize where the belief comes from. You know, if we stop dead in our tracks as the thoughts come in, take a moment to ask yourself, do I really believe this, or is this patterned and conditioned beliefs that I grew up hearing my mother say or my father say, and of course my grandparents before them said it, and all the aging adults around me, you know, would sit around drinking their whiskey, smoking their cigarettes. Well, you know, when I was younger, and there's sort of this expectation of aging, and as you age, the vitality and quality of your life goes down because, hey, that's just how it goes. When the reality is that as we age, we gain wisdom. And with that wisdom, we should also be able to retrain our thinking and also recondition how we live. We do not need to stay in the same patterns that we had for whatever reason. You know, you and I had a conversation just a couple of weeks ago about empty nesting and how we have those patterns of behavior just because we get into those patterns of being busy with our kids. Well, it's similar how we get busy with life, with our partnership, our career, our kids, and then we neglect taking care of ourselves so that we don't age beautifully and well and healthy. And it's about recognizing when you're starting to see that decline happen, when you start to make the excuses of like, oh, it's better I get my sleep than I get up early and hit the gym. It's better I do this than go for that walk. You know, oh, I could answer those 15 emails, or I could go for a run. I could do, you know, we're always prioritizing the wrong things because there's an arrogance to us of believing that there's time. We'll do that later. We'll catch up with that later. Whereas with health and wellness, you can't catch up to it. You know, you can't reclaim it once it's gone. So the biggest thing you can do for yourself, the biggest benefit you can give yourself, is continually finding the space and time to make sure that when you're 50, 60, 70, 80, you age healthy. You know, you age in a way that you can still get your overhead bag in the compartment, that you can still run up a flight of stairs if you need to do something quickly. You know, it's just, we let that slide because we prioritize the busyness of life rather than the wellness of life.
I think it's a question of adaptability, and I'm going to make a presumption here. You're a Gen Xer like me, I think, right?
I am.
So, like, I think Gen X, our superpower is the fact that we understand that nothing is static and we've had to change and reinvent ourselves 100 different times. I know 100%. I have. And so, you know, why is it that we shouldn't be continuing to do so? I actually think that actually keeps you young, or keep, perhaps a better phrase, keep you vibrant, keep you keep you going, is not falling into the patterns of I've seen this, I've done this, relying on the wisdom too much. Do you know what I mean? Like, I've done this before.
Oh, I totally know what you mean.
Like, I've done this before. I understand it. Therefore, I'm going to continue doing it. Well, no. You know, you have to continue to be curious. You have to continue to understand where you are in the world so that you can continue to be in the world. At least that's the way I see it.
Well, that is such an interesting point of view, because I share that sentiment that you have to continue to be curious. The mind leads the body, and it's not the other way around. So if you allow your mind to believe and fall into that, you know, toxic belief that aging is inevitable, and aging badly, more importantly, is inevitable. There's that, you know, I was just with my mom last weekend, and she's 75. We're only 18 years apart. And, you know, she was walking down the stairs at my cottage, and she was like, ooh, the knees just really can't do this. And I said, Mom, come on. You always talk like you got one foot in the River Jordan already. Like, you're still young. And then on the other hand, you know, one of our best friends is Rick Springfield, and he tours every weekend, and he's going to be 76 this year. Mm-hmm. Or is he 77? Anyway, 77. And he's still out there cranking. So really, it's your mindset around who you are and who you want to be and how you want to continue to show up in your life. And the only person that's ripping you off is your own thinking and your own patterns and your own reasons why. So there is, without curiosity, there's stagnancy. You know what I mean? And you see it so often with people, your parents and grandparents and whatnot. It's like when you retire, if you don't have a plan of action of how you want to spend your next 20 years, let's call it 30 years, you're going to sit on your couch. You know, so it's not the bucket list so much as I like to call it the living large list that we need to create, we need to invent, we need to have something to look forward to. And by looking forward to, this is what I want to do when I'm 65, 70, 75, 80. I mean, I was just on a ski trip with my husband. We were 5 weeks skiing with his family out west, and his dad's 80, and his dad skied every single day. And I'm not talking Bunny Hills. I'm talking he skied Revelstoke. Do you know what I mean? So it's really about, how do you want your life to look? Because we're so busy in our 20s planning our careers and the white picket fence and the marriage and the kids and the this and the that. And but we don't have a plan for our aging, you know, and that's the greatest disservice we do to ourselves is we stop dreaming, we stop believing, we stop planning, and we just sit and we wait. And that ages the body more than anything.
Okay. So all that being said, there are physical there are limitations, right?
Whether they're
cognitive or physical. Like, so for example, you know, I've exercised for years and I've got some wear and tear on me. And you know, when I wake up in the morning and, you know, I know there are muscle tears and I know there are tendon stresses, those are real. But how do we discern what's actually limiting and what we've talked ourselves into believing is limiting?
Which is a great question. As an ex-professional dancer, you know, you perform, you fall out of a jump, you twist your ankle. Well, you can't stop the show. You got to keep going, you know? And I have a couple of really good friends. Tessa Virtue's a great friend. Elvis Stoico, also a great friend. And I look to them for examples of what does it mean to persevere and through those limitations, because they are very real, you know. So let's not sugarcoat aging and injury and how that does cause a decrease in your ability to perform the way that you used to. So for me, you know, as an aging dancer, ex-dancer, I have to look more to, you know, Pilates and yoga. So it's not about continuing on in the lifestyle and the activity level and strain that you are used to. It's about, okay, well, how do I still do the things I love? And how do I continue to strengthen my body and keep my body, you know, limber and healthy while I have to deal with these very real issues? And, you know, the biggest thing, and my husband's a huge advocate for this, is, you know, finding good physiotherapists. And the beautiful thing about the internet and social media is there's a lot of really talented physiotherapists and trainers out there giving tips on how to continue to use your body and strengthen your body through injury. So, you know, because we can also make that excuse around, well, I can't afford it, or I'm too busy, I can't get to physio, or I can't get to this, I can't rehab my body because I just don't have the time or funds. Well, that excuse is out the window these days, just given the accessibility that we have. So I'm a big fan of that because I have to be. You know, I'm like, okay, well, you know, I can't weightlift 5 days a week. I can't do a soul cycle class 5 days a week because I have to spend 2 days, 3 days doing these sort of tendon stretching, muscles releasing exercises in order to be able to use my body in, you know, even a 50% capacity of how I used to be able to work it, you know?
Well, I can still do what I was doing, which was pretty intense.
That's amazing. Congratulations.
but there's a caveat. But I have to rearrange the way I do it because my body just needs more rest in between, which is, I think, kind of what you're touching upon, right?
100%. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, you can't get up and go like when you were in your 20s and 30s. You've got to listen to your body and work around its happy place.
you just have to be motivated to work around the injuries is the truth.
Amen.
You know, so we have time. We only have a few minutes more. How do you think society sort of plays into this and makes things more difficult? Like, I think social media and, you know, even what we see in legacy media sort of paints a picture of aging that I think is antiquated. I don't think it plays into the reality. Are you in agreement?
I am in complete agreement with you. You know, they're talking to, when I look at that, they're talking to the boomers who are already decided. For example, my mom, you know, who has decided she's old, and God bless her, that's how she wants to be. However, our generation, the Gen X generation, is, you know, saying, no, we don't subscribe to that. We're going to flip it on its head. And I think what's great about that is that we're also in a time where the demographic of women who are in perimenopause and menopause is the largest demographic it ever has been, which I believe is such a powerful movement. We're going to create such a good, positive conversation for the women beneath us to have. And I believe I see this in the men too. You know, my husband, for example, we're both 57. You know, he is very virile. He's, you know, like you, he still does all the things he used to do. He just has to do it in a different sequence and with a little more mindfulness. So it's really inspiring and encouraging because we're going to teach this next generation that there's no cutoff time. The cutoff time is decided by you, and that the power is in you to determine and decide how little and how much you can do. And I believe that's a beautiful, beautiful legacy to teach the younger generation, the generation coming up behind us.
Agreed. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Oh my gosh, you're so welcome. I love it.
Thanks to all my wonderful guests, Tanya Vriones, Shauna Lindzen, Serena Haynes, and Chantal Bisson. And thank you all for listening to The Tonic. You can listen or download this episode as a podcast with full show notes, contact information for our guests, and links at thetonic.ca. To find out more about the show, you can always follow us at It's The Tonic on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. For more timely, up-to-date, and accurate health and wellness information, subscribe to The Tonic newsletter. Now distributed once a week, The Tonic newsletter, with content curated personally by me, will keep you in the loop. There's contests, prizes, insider scoops, and so much more. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. If you're interested in providing feedback or suggesting topics for the show, you know you can always email me at jamie@thetonic.ca. On our next show, we'll discuss the health and wellness issues that are important to you. Until then, this is Jamie Bussin wishing you a healthy and happy week.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.